and as you approach the speed of sound, the amplitude of the sound goes to zero, and beyond the speed of sound, no matter how sensitive your microphone is, you never hear any of the sound at all through air. You'll still hear a little bit of the sound that's coupled through the metal of the airplane, but that's a different experiment. Over to you, Eric, KQLAW.
DDH with a comment.
Right. No, then I suppose we should go into what point is the sonic boom. Alright, thanks, Dick. That was an interesting thought. John.
You've got it, John.
Yeah, fine. This is WA2VDH. The handle is John. I was just going to comment on the sonic bluesing, because if you compare it to a plane going at Mach 1, passing an observer on the ground, he doesn't hear anything until the plane passes him, and that's all of the sound compressed together into the sonic boom. If the observer was moving ahead of the plane, he would never hear that sound at all if it was exactly at Mach 1. Go ahead.
Yeah, if you start getting down to the atomic level, John, sound is interesting. Molecules in the room with you right now at 70 degrees Fahrenheit are moving on average 500 meters per second. The individual speeds of the individual air molecules, 500 meters per second, is approximately 1.5 times the speed of sound. The individual molecules are moving that fast. Therefore, when you and I emit sound into that medium, we are taking some of those air molecules that were moving in all directions, 500 meters per second, and the way we create that pressure wave that goes out, it's called a longitudinal wave, is that we take some of the ones that were moving forward at roughly 500 meters per second, and we make them move a little bit faster than 500 meters per second, the ones going forward. And on that particular half cycle of the sound wave coming out of the loudspeaker, the ones that are moving in the inverse direction, 500 meters per second, get slowed down a little bit, maybe 490 meters per second. So the differential velocities of the individual air molecules are what gets carried forward as that so-called longitudinal wave. And so at the molecular level, at the atomic level, what's going on is a little bit more crazy, if you know what I mean. I was going to relate this to something else, but... repeat what you said, and I was going to add to it. You got it, John. W2VDH. W2VDH. KQLAW.
Yeah, fine business. Yeah, what I was saying is that actually what the sonic boom is, if a plane moving exactly at Mach 1 passes an observer on the ground, that sonic boom is all of the sound that the plane is emitting compressed all up into essentially zero wavelength, and it just appears as one big pulse of sound energy. So if an observer was to stay ahead of the plane, moving at the exact velocity of Mach 1 ahead of the plane, then he would the sound of the plane would never catch him. The plane would have to pass him for him to hear the sound of it if everything was moving at Mach 1. Go ahead.
But there's another subtle effect going on here, John. I've spent probably a year of my life on and off, altogether, at Edwards Air Force Base, Lancaster, California is the nearest major town in, it's not southern, let's see now, where is it? It's 30-some-odd miles northeast of Los Angeles is where Edwards Air Force Base is. At the Edwards Dry Lake at roughly 3,200 feet altitude. Anyhow, you stand on that Air Force Base and there's a whole lot of aircraft of various kinds, occasionally breaking the sound barrier. You don't hear a bang. You hear ba-doom. Each one of those sound barrier breakings you hear of an aircraft off at a fairly long distance, quite a few miles from you, is not a bang. It's a ba-doom. There's a double sound to it. The leading edge of the aircraft is giving you an extreme compression wave. That compressed wave moves a little bit faster. It's at a higher temperature, and it moves a little bit faster than the wave from the trailing edge of the airplane, which is a rarefaction wave, a partial vacuum wave. That's also moving toward you. but it moves a little bit slower. Even though if the airplane flew directly past you at the speed of sound, the amount of time it takes for the nose to pass you versus the tail to pass you is probably a millisecond, if you know what I mean. It's damn fast. And yet when you're miles away, the sound you hear from the leading edge of the plane and the sound you hear from the trailing edge of the plane are like a quarter of a second apart. That's because they're moving at a slightly different speed, because those two different waves are at a slightly different temperature. And the biggest thing that happens with the speed of sound in air, let me drop. The speed of sound in air at higher altitudes is much slower. Not because the air is less dense. That's an extremely minor factor. The major factor is the air up high is colder. Colder air, the individual air molecules are moving slower, the speed of sound is slower. Where the higher temperature exists, down low, the speed of sound is higher because the individual air molecules are moving faster. So that leading edge and the trailing edge of that sound wave, moving at those two different speeds, gives you that double sound, the doom. Over to you, John. I wonder if you've ever heard that, if you listened carefully enough. KQLAW in the TechNet.
Actually, I have heard that years ago. I think while the Concorde was still flying here, I think I could hear one of the early morning flights come in while they were still out over the ocean, where they would go subsonic. Way off in the distance, I would hear this faint double thump. You really had to pay attention to listen to it. But these effects I think you're talking about are sort of dispersive effects. What I'm indicating is if you were directly in line with the plane, and then you could stay ahead of it, moving at the exact velocity, the sound of the plane would never catch you and you would never hear it. You would never hear the sound of the plane. Go ahead.
I agree with that. If you're flying in another airplane that's flying at essentially the exact same speed as the airplane behind you, and you've got a microphone in the tail end of your airplane aimed toward that airplane that's behind you, and the airplane's making sound, and you're picking up the sound of that trailing airplane, and as you fly faster and faster, the pair of you, the sound wave that gets to you has traveled through a lot more air before it got there. It gets weaker and weaker, and as your two aircraft approach the speed of sound, you eventually hear nothing. The volume goes to zero, and now whatever sound that airplane makes, you never get it as you approach the speed of sound and get, you know, 1 foot per second beyond the speed of sound. So, I imagine there's a similar phenomenon with water. However, I don't think anybody has made a vehicle that moves faster than the speed of sound in water. Let me think about that. Have there been any boats that can move at, speed of sound in salt water is probably something in the vicinity of 800 miles an hour. I don't think anybody has made a boat that can move across the surface of the water at that speed. What do you think, John? W2VDH, K2LAW.
No, I don't think anybody has broken the sound barrier in water. I don't even think on the surface of the water, so I don't think that case will ever get experimented. One thing I have to keep reminding myself of is not to confuse this with light or anything or any electromagnetic effects. That's a whole different ballgame. Very interesting discussion. Back to you, Dick.
And before we leave this one of the questions that I posed during the week, I forget who I was talking to, maybe it was John. You got two spaceships moving at roughly the speed of sound, or speed of light. Two spaceships, side by side, both moving at the speed of light. And here's a real test of your relativism. I take out my laser pointer, and I shine it out the window of my spaceship toward your spaceship. What will you see? Does my laser pointer, does the light go straight across from our point of view of these two spacecraft moving at very close to the speed of light, that with relative to us, does that laser pointer give you one straight beam, or does that beam take a heavy curve toward the tail and never get there? What do you think on that one, John? W2VDH, K2LAW.
well, if they were connected, imagine them both moving at the speed of light, connected with a pipe or something, and you put the laser beam right down the pipe, it will go straight across. As far as an observer on the ground, I guess you would see it going at a slant angle because, the basis of the postulate is that the velocity of propagation of light is a constant independent of the velocity of the source or the observer. That's what all of relativity is supposed to stem from. So I think a pipe between them, the light would go straight across, but observer on the ground, it would be like a slant angle. Go ahead.
I agree with you, John. And so we have pure relativism here. These two spacecraft are moving at the speed of light, or very close to the speed of light, with reference to what? Might take the reference with reference to the Earth that's way behind us. And so these two spacecraft, as far as they're concerned, they're shining a light beam from one to the other, and it goes there under normal conditions. From their point of view, they could be sitting still and the whole darn universe is swishing by, if you know what I mean. It's a little bit crazy, but yes, the guy on the ground would see that pulse of light go across in a great big curve. Look what you started here, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, this comes from those conversations that you guys have talked about strange things. But good subject. Very easy. Right, let me let it drop on one to my next one. Okay, this is a lot easier. Gentleman has damage, and a Yagi, which had an end connector on it. He was able to knock all the elements, but the end connector is broken off, and it was, yarked, boom, riveted maybe, and he can't replace it. Possible that he could take coax cable, chassis, end connector, and somehow rig that, should he bother trying to attach it to the boom, and he just let it hang and terminate the wires on the elements where they belong. How do you think he should go about that repair, Dick? Back to you, KC2GB.
Yeah, to give a complete answer on this one now, John, you got to know a little bit more. The way you feed a driven element of a Yagi, there's probably 10 different ways of doing it. If that type N connector was grounded to the boom, and the center conductor went to a gamma match rod, where now you're launching current, center conductor is launching current onto the gamma match rod that runs parallel to the driven element, and the return for the signal coming out of the coax cable is where the shield of the coax cable is grounded to the boom, and the center element of the driven element is also grounded to the boom. So you're virtually launching current between the center of the driven element and the gamma match rod that's feeding energy into the driven element some number of inches downrange. In that case, the way you ground that connector and the number of inches will make a very slight change in the tuning, but the grounding is required in order to complete the circuit, so to speak. If at worst, with the modifications you make, you end up with some standing wave ratio on the Yagi, that is absolutely, positively not a showstopper. Because, let me drop. What makes a Yagi work and do all of its magic is each one of your parasitic elements, in the case of the directors, they're all tuned a little bit higher in frequency. They present a capacitive reactance. That means in free space, that's a slow wave structure. The signal traveling down the boom, then the signal near the boom when you're receiving, as it hits those first directors, the signal near the boom gets slowed down more than the signal that's further away from the boom. And you get this, you're starting to make a concave phase front of that receiving wave, and you're slowly focusing that energy down to the driven element. So the parasitic elements have to have a certain resonant frequency, and they're mounted at a certain position along the boom. That makes the Yagi work. And the same thing with the reflector. It's tuned a little bit lower in frequency, and it's a certain distance down the boom, giving you the right phase angle of reflection. The driven element only has to radiate in a dipole-like manner and give you a good impedance match to your transmission line. And the third characteristic is that the driven element, if at all possible, should be fed in a balanced manner, meaning that there is no unequal currents flowing down the outside of the transmission line, the coax cable. Let me drop it. So as long as you haven't changed the tuning of the parasitic elements and their locations, the only thing that determines the viswar of your Yagi is the resonance and the way you're feeding the driven element. If you're willing to take your driven element, which with the modifications you've made, you used to have a 1.1 viswar and now you've got a 1.7 viswar, and you're unhappy with that. It's a very easy thing to fix. By way of feeding signal into that Yagi while you're measuring the viswar, you're looking at the reflective power on a bird watt meter, for instance. And now you take a tuning tool. You've got a wooden stick with a piece of copper tape or aluminum tape on the end of the wooden stick, a little patch of the stuff, and you hold it near the tip of the driven element. You're adding capacitance to the tip of the driven element by holding that piece of metal there. You're taking the driven element and you're tuning it to a slightly lower frequency while you're watching the meter. Let me drop. And if the viswar goes down, you say, aha, I'm going in. If the viswar goes down, you say, aha, I'm going in the right direction, let's keep doing it. If the viswar goes up, you know you're going in the wrong direction, let's stop doing it. So in other words, if the viswar goes up, you put a piece of metal near the tip, you know that the driven element already is too low. If anything, it wants to be tuned higher. In which case, by whatever means, you're going to make the driven element look shorter. There's a couple of different ways you can do that. You can make it look shorter by taking a large piece of metal and holding it near the center of the driven element. A large piece of sheet metal, large piece meaning a couple of square inches, on the end of a wooden stick. And the wooden stick is long enough so you're standing outside of the field and not disturbing it. You hold this larger sheet of copper or aluminum near the center of the driven element. You're shorting out some of the local magnetic field that tunes the driven element to a higher frequency. So by metal held near the center, you tune the driven element to a higher frequency. Metal held near the tip, you're moving the driven element to a lower frequency. One of those directions is going to make the viswar get better. If it was a gamma match rod, by now changing the length of the gamma match rod, you're changing the impedance ratio. Whether the dipole is going to look like 50 ohms, 49 ohms, or 51 ohms, if you know what I mean. So adjusting the driven element. Let me drop. By making it physically longer or shorter, and you can make it longer with telescoping pieces of the tubing at the end, making it shorter by making it fatter in the center, putting a piece of metal near the center, just near it, not even touching it, adjusting the gamma match rod, spacing, length, the amount of capacitance of the gamma match rod, redressing the wiring between the type end connector and the driven element. No matter what you do to that driven element, as long as it is looking almost like a dipole, it could be fatter, skinnier, longer, shorter, whatever, if it gives you a good impedance match and radiates in a dipole-like manner, for you to make that driven element radiate in any other method than a dipole, boy, you'd have to do really wicked things. So for you to retune the driven element with all of the modifications you're making so that it now gives you a low viswar, the antenna's got to come back to the gain it used to have. Once again, a Yagi performs if the parasitic elements have the right tuning and they're in the right location, and the driven element just has to give you a good impedance match to your transmission line, and the whole darn Yagi will fly. So even if you see a higher viswar, don't be scared by that. Retuning it is easy. You're not going to be breaking the warranty, if you know what I mean. The antenna doesn't have a little trap door inside with a year's supply of food and a scorpion. If you break the seal on the Yagi because you've made modifications, something bad does not happen. Don't be afraid to tweak your Yagi. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Now let me finish that sentence. Don't be afraid to do anything you can think of to tweak the impedance and matching of the driven element of the Yagi. Leave the parasitic elements alone. You're changing the design if you do that. But you allow it to anything you want to that driven element other than adding a resistor in order to make the standing wave ratio get lower. Don't be afraid to tweak the driven element of your Yagi. Over to you, John.
WGB. Well, I'm sure he'll be happy to hear that. Rather an expensive antenna, and he really worried about this. It didn't sustain much damage as far as element bending and things like that. That went pretty smooth. This is really about this. But I suggest also that he could go to Mike Number 2's website and read a little bit about your Yagi experiment if he wants that information. Could you make it?
Yeah, I think that article is in both sites. When you go to the articles by K2LIW in both sites, without a doubt in the site that's labeled LimogTechNet.com. LimogTechNet.com. And there's a bunch of articles there by K2LIW. And one of them is entitled, How to Get a Perfect Impedance Match to the Driven Element of Your Yagi or to a Dipole. And there's about 1,500 words there with two diagrams to go with it that'll tell you just about everything you want to know. And I think that article is also appearing on Mike Number One's site, which is amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor. A bunch of articles by K2LIW are on that site. I think the article in question is on both sites, but I know it's on Mike Number Two's site for sure, which is limogtechnet.com. And people who have read that have usually come away very happy, saying, why hasn't somebody told me this information a lot longer ago? It'll wipe out an awful lot of the mystery of what goes on when you're feeding the driven element of a Yagi, when you're feeding any dipole-like structure. And once you know what you're doing after reading that article, by making some extremely minor physical changes of length to your dipole, and or adding a capacitor or an inductor across the drive terminals of the dipole, by making extremely minor modifications, you can make the load impedance of your dipole anything between 1 ohm and 1,500 ohms resistive, inclusive. If you want your dipole to be 993.1 ohms, if you want your dipole to be an impedance of 93.1 ohms for some reason, you're going to make it a little bit longer until the resistive component goes to 93. You're going to be left over with some inductive reactants. You put the right capacitor across the drive terminals, and the inductive reactants goes away, and now you've got a 93 ohm dipole. Nobody knows that. That's the world's best kept secret. The raw information for doing that has been hidden in plain sight since 1945, when it was published in the IEEE proceedings, IRE proceedings it was called then. It's been in Chapter 4 of every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. It's that set of curves by Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward that did a year's worth of work way back in 1945 to make those measurements. And so by way of that article, you can find out how to make the impedance of your dipole anything you want without going into great big mechanical structures and adding impedance matching transformers and whatever. Just adjusting the length and putting in one capacitor or one inductor, and now you can make it anything you want. Boy, is that a well-kept secret. It's been a well-kept secret for, what, 60 years, 1945 until now. I think that's 60 years. It's been hidden in plain sight, and I was at a major antenna IEEE
repeater. Time out.
I was at a major IEEE meeting of the Antennas and Propagation Society of the IEEE of Long Island, and I remember saying those words in a meeting with a bunch of antenna engineers, telling them that these very valuable curves explaining all this is in Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. And a number of these antenna engineers sitting in that meeting, and I could tell these guys with 10 and 20 years of experience, they turned around and said to me, what chapter is that in? They didn't know that. It's been well hidden from them also. JC2WJ meeting, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WG, there's a lot of information in that book, absolutely. In fact, I had a conversation this week with some about Rouse's book, Infinitesimal Dipole, which they did not believe that could be done, and I recommend that they read that book, and they are crafty people out there doing it every day. I think we got time for one more, Nick.
Absolutely. Fire away, John.
All right, Nick. We've got another question on RAM material this week. This gentleman has had heard your discussion about the chambers that you worked in, and he's wondering about the structure. You put an aircraft into this chamber, and these cones are mounted, whether they're rectangular or circular or spherical, that some of the emissions have to be hitting the right. And he wants to know, why doesn't that cause errors? And maybe you can explain the situation you explained to me about the ram on the floor and the few minutes of that, if you have time. He wonders why that doesn't cause a problem. Thank you, Dick.
Okay, RAM material. RAM stands for radar absorbent material. In many cases, it consists of polyurethane foam that at the time of manufacture, a whole bunch of carbon granules were mixed into the polyurethane material before it was bubbled and dried. Therefore, you get this very lossy, three-dimensional volumetric material, which sometimes is made in multiple layers, sometimes it's made in pyramid shapes. When the pyramid-shaped anechoic material is put onto the wall of an anechoic chamber, and most of the really good anechoic chambers are rectangular in shape, very few of them are in the shape of a cone. For a short period of time, people used to think that a cone-shaped chamber was better, and they soon discovered it was not, because the close-in material at the apex of the cone gives them a lot of local reflection to create some disturbing signals. So the really good chambers, most of them are rectangular in shape. So for the back wall of the chamber, for the ceiling and for the front wall and the back wall to have these pyramids aimed toward the center of the chamber makes a lot of sense. For the material that's on the floor, let me drop. For the material that's on the floor, for the signal that you're transmitting from usually the emitting antenna at the far end of the chamber, and quite often the antenna on the test is at the near end of the chamber and it's used in the receiving mode. And you've got a direct signal flowing through the air of the chamber, the direct path, that's the desirable path. You want all other paths to disappear. You got to worry about the fact that on the floor, you're now going to have the capability of radio signal hitting at a grazing angle for the material on the floor. In the case of the pyramids on the floor, if they're aimed up toward the ceiling, you're now at a grazing angle of that radio wave propagation. You're looking at the side of the pyramid. The flat side of the pyramid is quite strongly reflective. Even though you call it absorbing material, when you look at the flat side, it's reflective. For those pyramids to give you a real good absorption, you want the phase front of the wave to come straight at the material so that the sharp point of the pyramid material hits the phase front first, if you know what I mean, and that the sharp point slowly pierces that phase point, and what little signal hits the sides of the pyramid bounces back and forth between the two sides of the two adjacent pyramids and gets absorbed. Let me drop. So the material on the floor is a definite problem with the usual anechoic chamber. They get around that by changing the way you design the absorbing material on the floor. It's made in the form of not pyramids, but it's made in what's called ridge ram. In other words, you know what would happen if you plow the field, plow a farmer's field. You get these rows, and if you're looking down the rows in the longitudinal direction, so to speak, you now see a trough in between two hills, so to speak, and you're looking at the trough edgewise all the way down. If you design anechoic material that way as ridge ram, now you know there's no way that the signal at a grazing angle going toward the floor can look at the flat side of those of that anechoic material. It's now looking at those ridges end view, and the signal reflects back and forth between them and gets absorbed on each individual bounce. So real good chambers have ridge ram on the floor and the walls and the ceiling. They have pyramid material at the back wall and the front wall, and sometimes they have other kinds in between. There's a real art and science to designing radar absorbing material to cover the frequency range you want and to get the reflectivity as low as you want. When everything is working just right, there is only one direct path through air. Let me drop. Only one direct path in air that gets your signal from the transmitting device toward the receiving device, and no other path. If you've got a really good chamber, all other reflections in that chamber are at least 40 decibels suppressed. That's 1/10,000th of the power reflecting off the wall or the floor, if you know what I mean, compared to the direct path. That'll give you a pretty good chamber, and there are chambers that go beyond that. The most severe kind of chamber is a chamber that's used for measuring radar cross-section of an object. There you'd like all the echoes to be 60 and 70 dB down, and there are ways of doing that. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
QIS, query?
It sounded like QIS. Give me the full call and your name, sir, and then go right ahead.
This is AC2IS, Phil, and I had a couple of questions. One of them may be related to the infinitesimal dipole, A5S.
Yeah, very fine, Bill. Bill and I know each other very well. I just didn't recognize his voice at first. You haven't signed in for quite some time. Mr. Reeds, the chamber in the first issue of the issue of the first issue of Antenna book, the book entitled Antennas by John Krause, McGraw-Hill, 1950, has a chapter called the infinitesimal dipole. And the magic of an infinitesimal dipole is that when you take a full half-wave dipole and squeeze it down as small as you like, but re-resonate it, re-impedance match it, within 4/10 of a dB, you come back to the exact same gain, the exact same effective capture area. Everybody using common sense assumes that the area goes down as length squared. Good common sense, dead wrong. The magic of resonance, and as you make the antenna smaller, the resonance becomes higher and higher in Q. The amount of circulating electrostatic and magnetic fields near that antenna get bigger and bigger. The effective capture area within 4/10 of a dB comes back. And the 4/10 of a dB of gain loss is not lost. It's just a slight fattening of the pattern. Done correctly with low loss materials, you can still get 100% efficiency out of that infinitesimal dipole. And lots of articles you can find in websites will say something different. And so this is a controversial area, highly misunderstood. Go ahead with your question, Bill. AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. I had one question. A friend of mine asked if it was possible to build an SWR meter for 5.8 gigahertz. I mean, I think he already has plans he found on the internet, actually. If you search IB Crazy, that's India Bravo Crazy. This guy has a couple of good designs on building cloverleaf antennas in the 5.8 gig range, and also an SWR meter in that range. Break for a second. I guess the real question is, what are the caveats? What problems might he run into? My thinking at first was, an SWR meter is a precision instrument. The odds of you getting any reasonable accuracy with a DIY piece of equipment are probably kind of small. But on the other hand, finding a 5.8 gig SWR meter might be difficult slash expensive, so maybe this project does make sense. I think there are only a few components involved here, so I think he's going to go ahead with it either way. My other question is about sort of about the infinitesimal dipole. Let me let it break again. The question on the dipole, I think, are really isotropic antenna, theoretically, smallest antenna you can get, right? It's a point radiation source. I think that question is about antenna apertures. Really, if you have, say, a 10-watt transmitter connected to an isotropic antenna, and then at whatever radius away gives you, say, a 10 square meter surface area sphere, if at that distance you have another isotropic antenna, how do you predict the power that would be received at the other antenna? I would think, okay, 10 watts and then 10 square meters, so the power density there is 1 watt per square meter. But that's not the right unit, and I don't think that's the right answer for the power you get at the other antenna. I think the answer is related to the antenna aperture of isotropic antennas, which then gets to the question of what is the antenna aperture of an isotropic antenna, and why would it have a particular size? I think that size varies by frequency. I think that's all of my questions. This is AC2IF.
Now, Bill, you've got a nice, strong signal tonight. You must have put up a good antenna since I last talked to you. Is that true?
I'm still using the same MagMount antenna stuck to the side of an old computer case. It's sitting on top of a cardboard box in my living room. So not a lot of altitude, but 50 watts on a mobile radio. AC2IS.
Now maybe that's it, the 50 watts. It may be used to transmit with a rubber duck into a handy talkie, I'm not sure. You're a hell of a lot louder and quieter. You're dead full quiet. It used to be a fairly noisy signal. One step at a time. Measuring standing wave ratio at 5.6 gigs is not rocket science. Any vector network analyzer easily does it. And how does a vector network analyzer do it? There's a pair of directional couplers in there. One directional coupler measures the amount of signal coming out of the analyzer, going down your test cable into the device on the test. The other directional coupler measures the amount of signal coming back. The ratio between those two, with proper calibration, that is the standing wave ratio. For you to beg, buy, or borrow, or build a directional coupler at 5.6 gigs is easy. I own directional couplers that go up to 25 gigahertz, and I know the directional couplers that go way beyond that. Obvious by the fact that you can buy a vector network analyzer that goes to 100 gigs, and it does all of that measurement with directional couplers inside of the vector network analyzer. Once you understand the principle of operation of a directional coupler, let me drop. Whether you're building the directional coupler to operate at 100 megs, 100 megahertz, 1 gig, 10 gigs, 30 gigs, it's just a matter of slightly different size of the materials. Whether you build the directional coupler with dual plate strip line, tri-plate strip line, or as a microstrip, that's your choice. Whether you homebrew it. Now, I will admit that some of the older HF standing wave ratio bridges, in some cases it was done as an array of four resistors, it's sort of a Wheatstone bridge. For you to set up four resistors that are non-inductive and properly balanced at 5 gigs, that's difficult. Also, we used to build directional couplers by way of sneaking the piece of enamel wire underneath the braid of a piece of RG8 coax, the mini-mach or mani-mitch, however that's pronounced. That technique at 5 gigs would be very difficult. But to build a directional coupler at 5 gigs, build or buy, very easy. And then you use it in the forward direction after it's properly calibrated, and then measure it in the reverse direction and look at the ratio of those two powers out of the directional port. Easy. There's an article by K2RIW on using directional couplers for power in BizWa measurement. It's at mic number two site for sure, and I think it's also on mic number one site. Mic number two site is limogtechnet.com. You read that article and you'll understand directional couplers are not rocket science. They're not magic. Let me drop. And even if you have a directional coupler that was manufactured by Nodder or somebody else, and it's on the wrong frequency, that's not a showstopper. As long as it was built for a higher frequency than the one you use, and the article tells you how to do that. So for him to get his hands on a directional coupler that runs at 5 gigs, by modern techniques, is very easy, Bill. Let me think now. 5 gigs is 6 centimeters wavelength. A quarter wavelength would be 1/4 of that, 1.5 centimeters in air. So if the directional coupler was built in air, the directional line would be 1.5 centimeters long. With the usual dielectric properties of the printed circuit board you're likely to use, it's going to be roughly 1 centimeter long. So the actual directional coupler portion that's picking up your sample signal is going to be around 1 centimeter long. For you with a X-Acto knife and you know what you're doing after reading the right articles on the subject, that's quite easy, Bill. Don't let that stop you. Let me stop right there first before we go on to the next one. Over to you, Bill, AC2IS, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Hey, thanks. I believe he plans on purchasing the directional coupler. I think he's got a design that involves just one directional coupler, so he's probably just measuring the reverse voltage, and it very small circuit with only, you know, a handful of components, and one of them is a voltmeter. So I think that's the design he plans on going with. I think he's not really concerned about how much accuracy he gets out of it. He's just looking for the reverse voltage to be as close to zero as possible. AC2IS.
Yeah, if you really want to know the standing wave ratio, you take the ratio of forward power and reverse power. Even though you only own one directional coupler, you set it up to first measure the forward power, and you call that the calibrate point. Then you turn it around end to end, measure the reverse power, and after you do the proper calibration, because you're using a crystal detector and you've got to pull it down to voltage and that power and so on. But once you calibrate your system and you look at the ratio of forward to reverse, now you know the exact standing wave ratio. And if you're tuning up a device, yes, all you got to do is look at the reverse power and make it go to zero, and you're there. And so don't be afraid of this one. Just because you're up at a higher frequency than most hams have normally used, 5 gigs is at least 10 or 100 times higher than the average ham uses, it doesn't mean when you're up that high yet, though, that you're going to get a nosebleed. We all think that all kinds of magic happens up there, and everything's got to be done to the nearest thousandth of an inch. Because we haven't been there, we think it's critical as all hell. It's not. If you're using 5 gigahertz waveguide, and you have two pieces of waveguide, one that's WR90 and another one that's WR112, and you had to put them together, and you hold them together with a C-clamp, and you have these two unmatched pieces of waveguide, common sense would lead you to believe you're going to get all hell breaking loose when you slap these two things of two different sizes together. You actually do that and pour a signal down there and measure the standing wave ratio. It's about 1.3 or 1.4. The RF is nowhere near that critical if you know what you're doing. So he's got it made. Now, the second one was with reference to effective area of the dipole. Give me a couple of words again as to what your second question was, Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW.
This is AC2IS. And in regard to the first question, I think the only magic really is the performance of a particular diode that he's going to need. I think he needs a quote-unquote microwave diode. The other question really related to isotropic antennas, and I think what I'm to know about is the antenna aperture of an isotropic antenna, so that I can, I guess, go back to basic principles, figure out, given a certain amount of power into one isotropic antenna, at whatever distance, how much power should I be seeing coming out of a second isotropic antenna? I think in order to figure that out, I need to know the antenna aperture. In order to figure out the antenna aperture, I think that varies based on wavelength, which gives me kind of the counterintuitive result of the power that you'll get in and out of these antennas will vary depending on the frequency that you're transmitting on. AC2IS.
Yeah, you're 90% of the way there, Bill. I'm going to come back to that. Yes, when you're doing standing wave measurement at 5 gigs with directional coupler, you've got to have some kind of a receiving-like device that looks at the directional port power output and measures it. A microwave crystal diode detector can do it. Could you build a homebrew crystal diode detector with a tiny little Schottky barrier diode from Hewlett-Packard? Could you homebrew that easily? Easily. You're going to use very short leads. You're going to do it with a magnifying glass, unless you've got 19-year-old eyes, if you know what I mean. Magnifying glass or microscope. But to build a diode detector at that frequency is very easy. And if you really want it to go all the way down to zero power, you're going to put some forward current into the diode detector. And when you're using the diode detector less than minus 20 dBm, with some bias current of a couple of microamps into it, the diode will behave in a very predictable square law manner, the square law detector. But you're just trying to tune for a minimum, and so that's easy. Now, when it comes to effective capture area, the main formula that we all should burn into our brain. There's only one formula you really need for antennas. Let me drop it. And that is gain equals 4 pi a over lambda squared. 4 pi a over lambda squared, where a is effective capture area. The gain of an antenna will always meet that formula. You can rearrange the letters of that formula so that you solve for area instead of solve for gain. Area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. An isotropic antenna is the lowest gain antenna in the world at that frequency that still has 100% efficiency. You can't get lower in gain than isotropic, and if it's got 100% efficiency, you're there. Gain equals lambda, area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. When the isotropic antenna has a gain of unity, by definition, the G equals 1, lambda squared divided by 4 pi. That is the area. Because lambda squared is going down as a square lower frequency, yes. An isotropic antenna at a higher frequency, every time you double the frequency, it goes down 6 dB in effective capture area because of that lambda squared term. So area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. That tells you the exact area. You put in lambda in function and in units of centimeters, the formula will tell you exactly how many square centimeters is the effective capture area of your isotropic antenna. Let me drop. One other slight problem. In the case of an incandescent light bulb, a nice round white incandescent light bulb, it's very close to isotropic. You put 100 watts into that, you put it into a spherical room that has 100 square meters of area, you know you've got 1 watt per square meter of illumination from that light bulb. At RF frequencies, for all practical purposes, there is no isotropic antenna. Certain kinds of small antennas that are a mixture of a dipole plus a loop at right angles to each other, you can come close to making what looks like an isotropic antenna. But every antenna, no matter how small you make it, no matter how careful you make it, is not quite isotropic. That's a fancy way of saying if it's got 100% efficiency in some direction, its gain is a little bit above unity. But again, you plug it into that formula and you know exactly what the area is. Now, you're going to use that area, let me drop it. You're going to use that area with geometry in order to calculate how much power you should get. And if you want to double check this, write down this formula. Insertion loss, free space insertion loss, in decibels equals 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. I'll repeat that. Free space loss in decibels equals 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. F is frequency in megahertz. D is distance in miles. Don't be afraid to make that distance. Instead of miles, you make it feet or centimeters. You can easily calculate how many centimeters is in a mile. It's going to be a very small fraction of a mile. You plug it into that formula, it still gives you the right answer. So isotropic loss is that formula. You do it by way of knowing the area of an isotropic antenna. Do everything right, they will both give you the exact same answer within a tenth of a dB, Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thanks. So if the frequency learned about is 5.8 gig, then lambda squared is 5,800 squared, is that correct? AC2IS.
Quick note, Dick.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Frequency will be in megahertz, so 5.6 gigahertz is 5,600 megahertz, that's right, and you're going to be squaring it. Gain lambda squared, way down. It's not frequency, gain lambda squared over 4 pi. You've got to calculate that lambda, that wavelength, that frequency in wavelength. Take that frequency in meters, divide it in 3 exponential a, that's 300 million meters per second. Or if you want to do it in centimeters, it's 3 exponential 10 centimeters per second. So you're going to divide your frequency in hertz into 3 exponential 10 if you want it in centimeters, or 3 exponential 8 if you want it in meters. And that wavelength has got to be in the units you want, meters or centimeters, if you know what I mean, to get the effective capture area. KC2WGB, K2LIW, go ahead, John.
Dick, just want to let everybody know, EchoLink audio is out, so I'm getting notices on that. just to let people know. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Okay, I'm listening right now. I'm happy to see that the western, correction, the eastern repeater is working right now. I hear a little bit of hum on it, but it's working. But you're saying echo link is not there. That's too bad. So do you need a fill on any of that, Bill? That formula is wavelength, not frequency. The formula for effective area is wavelength, not not frequency. AC2IS, K2RIW.
I think I'm good for the moment. I think I'm going to try working some numbers while you talk about the next topic, and maybe I'll run a number against you in a little bit. AC2IS.
Yeah, what I think you're going to find out is that the first 3 feet of distance, isotropic insertion loss, it's going to be in the vicinity of 40 dB for the first 3 feet. Two isotropic antennas, 5 gigs. I'm doing a rough guess. I know exactly what it is at 915 megs, and 5.6 gigs is 5 times higher, 25, another 13 dB, 13 to 30. It's going to be about 44 dB of loss for the first 3 feet, isotropic. KC2WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
The audio came back on that loading. Yeah, seems like it's working now. All right, that's it from the mailbag, Dick. Back to you, sir.
Yeah, I can hear your voice coming back with a delay in the background there, John. Okay, it's time for the mailbag and
space report.
You got it, space report. Thank goodness I'm not getting old and senile. Paul, WS2N, is our space report person. I was looking at the September issue of Microwave Journal magazine, and one page before the last page is an advertisement for a book on living on Mars. Somebody has come out with a brand new book advertising it in Microwave Journal about Elon Musk is predicting that he's going to create a tribe of people. Tribe's not the right word. He predicts that 80,000 Americans will be living on the planet of Mars in the year 2040 because he's going to create the spacecraft that's going to get them there. Wow. As you know, I do not believe that. There's a bunch of reasons why. And he thinks they're going to go there and they're going to terraform Mars. Okay? What do you need most on Mars that's not there? Let me drop. You really need an atmosphere. You don't like all that ultraviolet rays from the sun hitting you. You don't like all those meteors and meteorites and comets hitting you. You really want an atmosphere. You got to go somewhere and steal a whole planet's worth of atmosphere and put it there on Mars. Now, it turns out that Venus has an atmosphere that's got 150 times the pressure of the Earth. So you could say Venus has got 150 times too much atmosphere. So by some means, you steal the atmosphere from Venus. Well, Venus consists of a whole lot of sulfuric acid, but some of it is non-sulfuric acid. You're going to take that air. You're going to steal it from Venus and bring it over to Mars, okay? By some means, you're going to create a molten core of Mars that already cooled off, and you're going to create a magnetic field. You need that to give you protection from the solar wind. And so you're going to have air. You're going to add a whole lot of oxygen. And you also have to add a whole lot of water. By some means, you're going to go and get a planet's worth of water and put it on Mars. Once you do all of that, can you move your 80,000 colony there? Absolutely. Can you imagine the degree of difficulty of doing that, Paul? WS2N with the space report, K2IW in the TechNet.
Living on Mars is a very good book. I think I read it. Just came out, too. So it's not that many pages, I'll tell you that, but it's very well done. And he's got some good predictions, and yeah, he talks about terraforming, and don't forget this is going to take 1,000 years, you know, so it's not going to happen overnight. Where these 80,000 people going to stay when they get there? Elon Musk has the Mars colony transport. That's what he plans on bringing them there with something that would make the Falcon 9 look like a toy.
Dick, quick note. It appears that Bernie needs to drop the repeater for a second.
Okay, as soon as
today is October 4th.
Stand by, Paul. Turns out that Bernie's got to do something with the repeater. You got it, Bernie. KTLAW in the group.
Yeah.
John, is Bernie going to tell us when we're ready to use it again? Over to you, John.
I think he's trying to reset that system, so let's give him another minute. I'm not kidding. I just haven't noticed that he said he needed to drop it. I didn't get one that he's complete, so we'll give him another minute.
Roger.
Bernie, by the way, there is no audio on Echolink at this time.
Echolink is working again.
Thank you, Rich.
Okay, Dick, it sounds like we're back in business.
Now stand by until we hear from Bernie. Hold on. Bernie, tell us when. Or John, you tell us when Bernie told you when.
Heck, we're up, Dick. Try it again.
Okay, sounds like we're back in almost operation, although the audio is quite a bit lower. And it sounds to me like I'm going through a great big long pipe. So, 80,000 colony on Mars. You've read the book. I've forgotten the author's name. It was in the September issue of Microwave Journal where it was advertised. Where did you find out about the book? Sounds like you've had it for a while, Paul. And do you believe it's all going to take place by 2040? All of that terraforming? I mean, the word terraforming, in other words, reforming a planet so it's just like the Earth, those words roll off the tongue very easily. But all of that very thin atmosphere that's left on Mars, 0.2% of Earth's atmosphere, all of that boiled away. It's gone in space. You can't just dig down a couple of feet and re-establish that atmosphere. You've got to put that material back on that planet. It's got to come from somewhere. I mean, it sounds like a little too much of a bootstrapping operation from my point of view, but maybe I'm just a little too negative. WS2N, tell us how they're going to do it, Paul. K2LIW in the Tech Minute. Here comes the space report.
Okay, this is WS2N. It's Stefan L. Petrankic, P-E-T-R-A-N-E-K. I will live on Mars. I got it right here. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right. I'm always keeping a lookout for interesting books. It's not in the library yet, so you have to go over to where it's Barnes & Noble. They have it. And let me see how many pages. Very short, but very well done. Got here. I don't know, it's probably about 78 pages. Yeah, he's sounds like he's a Elon Musk fan. But so am I, so what are you going to do? I wanted to mention before the repeater being worked on. Today is October 4th. So that means it's 58 years since Sputnik went up. And I find that really amazing. So of course, I was around then. I was a little kid. But talks about this, looking out, looking for it in the sky. I didn't see it, but Sputnik 2 feet in diameter. You know, maybe less than a couple hundred pounds, four antennas sticking out of it, and people are trying to look for this. And I think they really weren't seeing it. I mean, they did say they saw it, but I think what they saw was the final stage that went up. Sputnik didn't have any thrusters on it or anything. It was just released. But that other, the final core did go up with it. In fact, the Russians made it very shiny so it could be seen, reflected from the light, dawn and dusk. But it's been a long time. We've come a long way from there. We've had hundreds of launches per year.
interesting enough, the amateur community listened to Sputnik was on 20 megahertz and 40 megahertz, 20.005 and 40.002 megahertz. So, you know, it's pretty close to 15 meters. It was heard. It did a lot of tests. It wanted to see how the radio waves were going to bounce up the ionosphere and all. And here we are now, almost 60 years.